Welcome to the panel, and Neville Gibson is on it today, editor of the National Business Review, and Steve McCabe is with him, teacher, physicist, and geek.
Thank you.
Well, geek's a compliment these days, isn't it?
I took it as one.
A piece of sticking plaster on your face? I don't mean to be personal, I'm just inquiring.
No, it's there for a reason. I'm getting old, basically. I'm getting all these like old man ailments. I mean, I injured my knee about 20 years ago skiing. For the last 20 years it's been fine, but suddenly in the last month it's creaky like you can't imagine. I can barely even walk, and I've got this thing growing out of the side of my face recently. I went to the doctors, and he sort of muttered the C word, but said, you know, I know, but then it turns out that it's a kind of skin cancer that possibly a third of the population will get in their lifetime and never metastasizes and never goes anywhere. But good. Worth getting whipped out anyway. So I was down at the doctor's this morning having that thing taken out, and you know, have a nice little scar there to impress the kids at school tomorrow.
You're just generally a physical mess at the moment.
I'm just collapsing and dying out. I'm old, basically. Simple as that. It's terrible.
Neville, on the other hand, you look very well.
Well, I've been to Dunedin Gym on a weekend trip, which was very invigorating.
What did you do down there?
I went to the Otago Foreign Policy School. That's been running for nearly 50 years, I discovered, because I went to one of the first one. It's really for people who are interested in foreign affairs. It's not an academic one. It does have academics and experts there. Occasionally the ex-politician. We had Major General Rambuka there, who's been interviewed widely in the last few days. Mm. But he's basically started his election campaign. They hope to have an election in Fiji next year.
Right, so he was...
So he's campaigning down here, where a lot of Fijians live, actually.
Okay, so he was trying it out on the audience.
We're also, the other topic, it was really about the Pacific, a whole lot of islands spread across the globe. There was the sort of colonial era, the fact that none of these places are linked up by any air links. The old colonial powers are still important. And, of course, you have two new powers in the Pacific, Taiwan and China, competing for diplomatic recognition from these tiny states that do have a vote in the UN and other world bodies.
How much of a power is Taiwan in the Pacific compared with China, though?
Well, they had a lot of money to start with, and then the Chinese have overtaken them. And then about 3 or 4 years ago, a kind of truce was called, and they agreed to let the status quo stand so they didn't have to outbid each other, building big embassies and so on. One or two nations did switch their diplomatic allegiances.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's also fantastically symbolic, isn't it? That they want to be seen to have legitimacy, and one of the ways they get that is to have recognition. And even if they're going for tiny, relatively unknown countries, the fact is, I got one more than you did this week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And, of course, the Americans have belatedly decided that the Pacific is their patch as well.
That's right. They've come back. That's the so-called pivot, but that word's no longer in use.
Is it not? No. So what is the outcome? I mean, I suppose this is a...
Well, the outcome is that you can discuss a lot of these things and end up with... especially when you've got a lot of experts with strong views, not agreeing with the last speaker you heard, because they sound quite compelling.
Yes.
And I don't think there's, when it comes to Fiji and some of these other issues like the air links, probably nothing, but you do sense a lot of frustration. Even Murray McCulley, foreign minister, was there. He was basically said, there's only one big resource, that's tuna. Mm. And internal travel between these various nations is very, very low and very, very expensive.
It's interestingly poised right through the Pacific now, isn't it? In terms of who is going to, you know, who will end up with the hegemony.
Well, that's one of the words they use, and it's not an easy word to explain, but they mostly agreed that there was none now.
Right.
That all these powers, including France, of course, Australia, New Zealand, basically all cancel each other out and nothing changes.
It's like a game of diplomacy, isn't it? Steve McCabe also meant to mention that, as far as I'm aware, you're the first royal person we've had on the panel.
I am very glad I'm finally getting the recognition that I actually deserve here. It's been a long time coming.
Steve's been on a genealogy website, Neville, and he's discovered he's related to the Queen.
22nd cousin, I believe, twice removed, I think is what I figured out she was. And that's just the first connection I've come up with. That's through... the thing is, it's all through my mother's maternal grandmother's line, and said grandmother was in fact adopted, and so my wife keeps telling me that something doesn't count, and that makes me non-royal, but I'm sorry, I'm sticking with it. It's good enough for me.
No royal box at Wimbledon, though, I notice.
Well, I did also discover that in addition to this direct line through Sir Richard Le Puy, who was my...
Oh, yes, Sir Richard.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Oh, you remember Dick, don't you? Yeah. He's about my 20-something great-grandfather, who was the last common ancestor I had with the Queen. That's one route. But then also, if you keep going further back through some dignitaries of Salford in northwest England, you also find a connection by marriage to a Lord of the Isles in Scotland. From there, you can trace me back to William the Conqueror and Edward the Confessor. So I've got a saint in the family as well.
Look at the time.
We can talk about my fridge, my cooker, if you'd rather, Jim.
So you'd be a starter for a new version of Who Do You Think You Are?
Oh, I know exactly who I am at this point.
I thought they all came from Germany. The current royal family.
We prefer not to talk about that branch of the family, if you don't mind. It's a bit embarrassing.
Steve is on the panel. And Neville. And let's go with the topics. The Māori Party co-leader, Peter Sharples, says it's clear to him that uncertainty about the party's leadership was damaging its support. That's the way he's put it. And he's announced he will step down as co-leader at the annual general meeting in a couple of weeks. And as everybody knows, it's expected that Te Ororoa Flavel will take over the co-leadership. So, yes, it's an important... Now, what's happening here? It's an important regenerative principle, of course, that the tree has to fall to make space in the forest canopy. Is it that simple? Or is it worse than that, as it were, that the Māori Party, as Honi Harawira alleges, you know, is paying the price for cozying up to the Nats and estranging themselves from their political base? What do you think is happening here?
Well, I think the Māori Party was always a fairly, not a distinct thing, but it was based on race around one issue. And, of course, it attracted a lot of non-Labour thinking people. And so some of them would have agreed with Dr. Sharples going in with National, because at least they got a few concessions,
yep,
and they were using a system. But in the end, I think it comes back to economics, and the Mana Party proved that there's, you know, that's where the vote is, really. So I don't think Mr. Flavel may stay in Parliament, but he'll be the only one on the current sort of polling.
So are you predicting a demise?
Essentially, yes. Yeah.
All right.
And it certainly probably does. It should do the Māori Party a good deal of good to be in with National, because we've had a very strong economy and it's benefited most people. And certainly beneficiaries who have done pretty well too, because at least they've kept up with inflation and that sort of thing. And that's a good news story.
Has it lost the fire, though? Because it formed around Tariana, didn't it? And the foreshore and seabed issue.
Well, they ran out of issues, essentially, I think.
Okay.
And that'd be about the end of it.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is the fact that you've got a small party throwing its weight behind a larger party to form a coalition when it doesn't entirely buy into that party's philosophy. All that can end up happening is that it's going to get associated with the larger party's policies. In this case, you know, the Māori Party is going to get tarred with National's brush. Whatever National do, for example, asset sales, is going to be perceived as something that the Māori Party have now signed off on as well. And it's not going to play well with their constituency. The same thing happened in Britain, it's worth noticing, with the Lib Dems forming a coalition with the Conservative Party. Nick Clegg, these days, the Lib Dem leader, has become a laughingstock in Britain, because he is getting none of the policies that he campaigned on in any way recognised by the Conservatives. But all that is happening is he's being associated with policies that he had previously distanced himself from. And I think possibly that's what Honi Harawira is hinting toward with his remarks.
Do you see any future for some kind of amalgamation of Mana and Māori, either of you?
Well, I think Harawira has made it very, very clear that it has to be his party. And so as long as he's not allowed to be leader of the Māori Party, then no.
I think we're going to see quite a few of those politicians have to join a major party, because Peter Dunn, if he stands again, John Banks, have no future with their independent parties at all. And if Nationals stood against them in an electorate this time round, I'd say they'd grab those seats. So it's better for them to go and join those parties. And the Māori seats, it's pretty much the same way. If you don't join the Labour Party, you may not get in.
Okay. And you see it's quite possible that National won't have a partner to speak of going into
Well, that's where Winston comes into it, doesn't he? Mm. I mean, if he can get over that 5%, that's the critical thing, and then there'll just be the four parties in Parliament.
Thank you. Somebody knows one of the ancestors that you referred to, Steve McCabe, and says he was a dubious fellow.
Which one? William the Conqueror?
No, well, he probably was a dubious fellow, depending on which side of the battle you were on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'll go
It would be Sir Richard Le Puigne. Well, was one to mention, yeah.
Very good. New Zealanders scoffed $1.5 billion worth of takeaways last year, and that is an increase of more than 9% on the previous 12 months. That's a big increase. The spending is detailed in a report on the state of the hospitality industry, released by the Restaurant Association and the Auckland University of Technology. And it shows takeaway sales have risen 25% in 4 years. Despite all the warnings, despite all the education from health authorities too. And Dr. Robin Tumuth will join us shortly. But what do these figures tell you, please?
I think it means we've given up on eating at home for no good reason. I think it's an awful shame that we don't cook at home and eat at home. It's a healthier, it's a more healthy environment in which to eat as a family together. I mean, one little exercise that my wife and I did, I was reading through the briefing notes that we got sent, was a reference to a family getting a fish and chip supper, a family of four, fish and chip supper for a tenner. And I think that's great, that's what people are tempted to do. So we looked at the website of a fairly well-known supermarket chain in New Zealand, and we put together a little shopping list. You can get 500 grams of mince for $6, two heads of broccoli for $2.50, and a kilogram of potatoes for $2. So it's for $10.50, about the same as you're getting for a fish supper. You can have a homemade, healthy, fresh meal with fresh green veggies in it. Why are we not doing this? I think we've just given up.
Jim, I think the figures look alarming, but when I checked out the full report, takeaway food services was just part of, six other sectors, including cafes and restaurants, catering, pubs and taverns and bars and that sort of thing. The figures are not that horrendous. And if you go back to 2008, if you track inflation, increased number of people and the amount spent overall, the proportion hasn't changed that much at all. In fact, the only area that's gone down in total sales are clubs, and of course they are a dying thing anyway.
Okay, let's find out how Dr. Robin Tumuth has unpacked the figures. She is, of course, an endocrinologist based at Auckland Hospital and a long a campaigner against obesity. Dr. Robin Tumuth joining us now. Hello, Robin.
Hi.
Do you agree with Neville that once you delve into the figures, the problem's actually not getting worse, or do you read it differently?
Well, I haven't had a look at the figures in that much detail, so I don't know whether or not they're getting worse or not. But the reality is that the diet of the average New Zealander is very, very poor. You know, what we need to think about is just what are we needing to do to move this along and get it in the right direction. I mean, so far, you know, all of the accumulating evidence that's coming through is that we're just getting further and further behind. You know, so whether or not these particular figures precisely say that fast food outlet consumption is getting worse is probably neither here nor there. The population is getting more obese, and we're consuming a diet which is becoming more and more unhealthy all the time. We just have to start thinking about solutions.
Okay, let's assume you're right for the purposes of discussion. Mm. You cannot, I mean, Steve McCabe says people have given up, which is a fairly blunt way of putting it, but it also says, doesn't it, you can't educate people out of eating junk if they want to, or eating fast food, perhaps is a kind of way of saying it, if they want to.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, I don't know whether giving up is true. I don't think it is, really. I mean, this is a very, very recent phenomenon, this change in behaviour. If you listen to Alistair Woodward, the epidemiologist analysing these figures, you know, this is something which theoretically we should be able to turn around. And we haven't even tried to turn it around. We haven't thought about making this ridiculously cheap. You know, it's very tasty, it's very convenient, it's there 24 hours a day, wherever you look, and it's incredibly cheap. We haven't tried to make this food more expensive. We haven't tried to restrict the number of outlets. We haven't tried to restrict the size of the portions that are sold in these outlets. We really, you know, we haven't done anything to try and, you know, to turn this around yet.
There are people like, you know, Theodore Dalrymple, I remember, he says, his opinion was that people know what is good for them and what isn't. It's not the supply side, it's the demand side. They are demanding the food. That is an argument, at least, isn't it, Robin?
It is, but I don't know that it's right, actually. If you look historically at the supply of calories to a population over time, you will find that the population becomes heavier with more calories supplied to it. And when you've got food subsidies that that, for example, produce a whole lot of corn that gets turned into syrup. This has to be distributed and got rid of in the population. I mean, milk is produced in some parts of the world in vast excess and gets turned into milk powder. There is an equally valid argument that the supply is driving the consumption.
All right, but then you have to decide that the state will have a more providential role in deciding what is good for people. That's the consequence of that if you go down the route that you're beginning to describe of restricting outlets and so on.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, we do that absolutely all the time. We distribute, you know, taxation revenue, and we do so many things in our modern communities to improve the health of the population, and this would just be another one of those things. I mean, we've long got over any kind of reticence about controlling cigarette smoking. We think it's perfectly reasonable that we should restrict alcohol to certain groups in the community and that we should tax it to make it more expensive, not as expensive as it should be, mind you. And yeah, we do need to get our head around, what can we do that makes it more likely that the population consumes a healthier diet. I mean, that's what are the things that we can do to assist people eating more healthily? We collect data after data. You know, the Ministry of Health, you know, collects all this data saying a lack of fruit and vegetables in our diet is a significant factor in, you know, a whole range of cancers and other, you know, health-related problems. We have to get over this reluctance to actually front-foot it and do something about it. And we've got so much evidence that education alone is not powerful enough to combat the genetics which drive us to eat. It's a very normal physiological thing to try and store up food. And you combine that with this environment where all of this tasty, really cheap food is everywhere, and, you know, you get what you get.
Except that we get addicted, or at least some people do, don't they, to smoking and to alcohol. And the argument for state intervention is probably more cogent as a result of that. Are you saying people get addicted to junk food?
No, I don't know that the arguments against, you know, controlling alcohol and tobacco are based on addiction, because the addicted people are still addicted and they still have their problems. What we do is we restrict the supply of alcohol and cigarettes actually to the non-addicted or the less addicted people. And who's to say that, this, as I say, this physiological drive to eat, which is extremely powerful, but different in different individuals, and there is no question that those individuals who become obese in this environment do so because of their genetic predisposition. No question that that's the reason why one person is skinny and the next person is fat. You know, so these are very powerful genetic drivers that may be at least equivalent, and certainly in terms of their effect in this obesogenic environment, we can see that it's at least as powerful as an addictive problem.
I think one of the problems that you're going to run into, however, at this point, is if we start talking about some form of regulation or control, then trying to actually specify what exactly is that we're going to regulate is going to be very, very difficult. I understand that in many fast food outlets, they are serving very, very calorie-dense meals, but are all calories created equal? If you've got a very, very protein-heavy dish that's 500 calories and then an extraordinarily sugar-heavy dish that's similarly 500 calories, they are not going to have the same glycemic impact, for example.
No, well, I don't think the glycemic impact is the concern here. It is the sort of the actual calories if we're talking about obesity. But you're right that, I mean, there's sort of good calories and bad calories, and there's very sophisticated nutritional assessments which actually allocate points, you know, plus and minus, so that, you know, you can end up with a scoring system which said this is a good food or this is a bad food, which takes into account the calories plus the other nutrients. So, for example, an avocado has a lot of calories in it, but these are vegetable oil calories, and there's a heck of a lot of nutrients. You know, comparing an avocado with a Big Mac or something like that, you can, using tools like this, say, actually, you'd be much better to eat the avocado than the Big Mac. So it's not the case that people don't know where to start. There are loads and loads of suggestions as to where we start.
Yeah.
I mean, if you wanted to start, you could start with soft drinks, because that's, you know, that's more straightforward. Nobody can argue that we should be consuming soft drinks or that soft drinks are good for us to have. They're bad for our teeth, they're bad for our weight, they're far too cheap. You know, we could start there.
As you say, we know all this. I wonder, instead of a genetic predisposition, because then the question is, you know, who is predisposed and who isn't, what about a social predisposition? I mean, we live in a time-poor society, we lead more sedentary lives, We spend more time in cars than our ancestors did, who didn't have cars. All the conditions are ripe, are they not?
Yes, I think they are. And I think that they track together. And yes, it would be fantastic if we could improve the income of, we know that obesity occurs more commonly in the lower socioeconomic groups, although it certainly occurs in very intelligent, very well-heeled members across the society. But yes, wouldn't it be fantastic if people could earn a great wage so that they didn't have to work two jobs, that maybe only one person in the household needed to work, as they did in the 1950s, and that people had time to grow vegetable gardens and whatever. Yes, of course. But, that's probably as realistic as changing somebody, to change those things is probably about as difficult as changing people's genotype. But we can gently nudge people into more healthier lifestyles, as we have shown certainly with cigarette smoking, by making it a bit harder to eat the garbage and a bit easier to eat the good stuff.
Why don't poor people eat as well, then, as people who are better off?
Well, there's a myriad of reasons, but one of them is the time poor thing. I see patients in hospital who are, honestly, they're working two jobs. There are a whole bunch of people all living in the same house. They don't all, collect together and eat a home-cooked meal because everyone's coming and going at their different jobs. They're living in suburbs where there are acres upon acres of fast food outlets. They're so unevenly spread throughout the community. They may be living somewhere where they're miles away from a supermarket. There's a whole load of reasons.
And a difficult problem to solve, Robin.
But we've got to start. By God, we've got to do something. We've got to start on this. Otherwise, we're just going to drown.
Dr. Robin Toomath, thank you very much.
And isn't it awfully ironic that not that long ago, being overweight, being obese, was in fact a sign of richness and prosperity?
Yeah. But then everybody from every socio-economic class had access to food, not just the wealthy.
That's true.
Yeah.
Jim, the good news in this report, and obviously that got left out, and is that international trends among restaurants and what so-called fast food outlets, which are selling and making a lot more local food, healthy food with wider menus and that sort of thing. And so that's the good news. And that trend's really taken off in the United States and will probably flow through here as well.
And in many respects, in terms of the general diet, food has got better.
Well, it's not only got better, it's cheaper.
Yeah, but I mean, there's
but
a lot more nutrition
available. But the bad food's also cheaper as well, yeah.
Well, do you agree with Robin Toomath or not, just before we leave the topic, that we've got to start something somewhere?
Yeah, the people like her have, in their studies, have basically, it's not the food itself, it's a lot of these other behaviours, and that's the real hard one. You try and change people's habits, that's really hard.
Would you ban the soft drinks, tax the soft drinks, tax the big bottles of soft drinks?
That's where you start, because if you think, look, for example, you're talking about alcohol, you're talking about tobacco. These are very, very different from food in general, because you can live without them. We can't live without food. We need to get some sort of finessing of that one. But soft drinks? No, I mean, there's a reason why Coca-Cola have to keep advertising, and they don't advertise anything good about the drink. They advertise the lifestyle, because we realise that there's actually nothing about the drink that's actually particularly worthwhile. Stop it. There's no reason for sucking down that much sugar on a daily basis does you no good.
Steve McCabe, Neville Gibson on the panel, back with them shortly. Mike Hodge with the news headlines.